The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Jessen, Werke, Hooten, Judge Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
And good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is June 3rd and we are hearing two oral arguments via WebEx this morning. The first matter is Robert Branchen versus Therese Weitzel, respondent number A19-1344. We only have one of the parties before us today for oral argument. So Mr. Boulette, whenever you're ready, if you would begin your argument by stating your name for our audio recording, as well as who you represent. And then, as you're well aware, under our rules, which are the same via WebEx as they are in the courtroom, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument. So with that, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge Jessen. May it please the court, Michael Boulette here on behalf of respondent Therese Weitzel. I want to acknowledge at the outset today, a little bit unusual. I'm arguing as respondent without an argument to respond to specifically, but I did think that given the unusual procedural posture of the case in front of you, it may be helpful to be able to ask questions and to really flesh out the two principal arguments in respondent's brief as to why this appeal should fail. I'd like to begin first with where we stand. These parties divorced in 1999. And really their primary asset to which Ms. Weitzel was entitled was equity in a home. And that home was to be sold approximately 10 years from the date of divorce. And because of a reconciliation by the parties, that sale didn't begin until 2015. So as we sit here now on June 3rd of 2020, appellant's been ordered to sell this home first in the 1999 decree, second in a 2015 enforcement motion, third in a 2016 enforcement motion, and now again in a 2018 set of amended orders. So we have four separate orders, all requiring Mr. Branchen to sell the home. Critically for your review, he's only appealed the most recent orders. He's only appealed the 2018 amended orders. He's not appealed the 2015 enforcement order that was previously entered against him. That's particularly important for your review because the time to appeal that 2015 order has passed. Now, calculating that deadline is a bit complex because this was not an issue, an area where. So I'm going to pause for a second.
We're hearing you now.
Okay. Calculating the deadline for that 2015 order is not necessarily obvious, in part because the proceedings were consolidated in early 2016. However, at the very latest, the deadline for appealing that 2015 order ran in October of 2019, which would have been 60 days after the final order disposing all remaining issues in this case. We know that because Mr. Branchen sought amended findings with respect to the 2015 order. That motion was denied, a notice of filing was served, and then due to the consolidated nature of the proceedings, at most, Mr. Branchen could have waited till 60 days after the child support decision was rendered. He didn't do that.
So, Mr. Boulette, just so that I understand, I was trying to get to the bottom of this dispute about Judge Bryant's, you know, the statements he made in open court, I think it was October 18, and how perhaps they conflicted with the order he executed the next month. Do we have to even reach that?
You don't. That was the primary basis for, on the motion for findings, for the court exercising its discretion to say, I need to go back and change what I did prior. Oral statements versus his written statements was really the crux of why the court needed to go back and amend. But you're not here looking at the propriety of the amendment or not. You're here looking at the base issue of, did the court abuse its discretion by enforcing the property settlement? And that doesn't require you to reach any of the amendment issues.
Could you explain to me how it came about and what was the agreement of the parties relative to the appointment of a special master?
I can't explain.
And what was the understanding as the scope of the issues before the special master?
Again, one way to think about it, Judge Hooten, is that when the parties were in court, they were essentially litigating two cases under one case file number. On the one hand, they had custody, parenting time, and support issues with respect to their youngest son, who was born after their divorce. On the other hand, they had enforcement issues arising from their 1999 judgment decree. In 2016, all of those issues got consolidated, and so they were all proceeding apace in front of a single judicial officer. The parties ultimately found that really inefficient because there were so many issues in the air, we couldn't really get the case straightened out. And so what the parties did is stipulated to the appointment of a consensual special magistrate who in essence took over everything from the 1999 divorce, leaving in front of the district court all of the issues with respect to their youngest son, his custody, child support, et cetera. So the CSM was a stipulated appointment to essentially take all of the 1999 issues and place them in front of a single decision maker in a separate process.
Here's my question with regard to that 2015 order. If there was an agreement that all these issues should go in front of the special master, would that have told about per agreement any requirement that there be an appeal from that order?
Well, it could have if we were calculating the deadline for appeal based on when the 2015 order was entered. But that's not how we calculate the deadline. I'm trying to be as conservative as I can in giving Mr. Branchin the benefit of the doubt on when that appeal deadline would have run. So even if we assume that we look at Rule 104, I think it's 10401 Subdivision 2, and we say he had 60 days from when the special master made her decision, and even then, that would have still run, it would have run well over a year ago. But the proceeding was consolidated, so let's give Mr. Branchin the further benefit of the doubt that he had till 60 days after the last issue in this consolidated case was decided. That would have still been November of last year. And because he didn't include the November 15 order within the scope of review, the time to review that order has lapsed. So at a base level, what we have here is preclusion. And Mr. Branchin is trying to argue that really the 2015 order says something different than it does, but we can look in the record and see that that's not the case. And we can see that for a couple of reasons. First, the orders Mr. Branchin appeal do no more than say, I'm enforcing or reaffirming rather the 2015 order. There's nothing new in these amended 2018 orders that isn't simply restating the same requirements with slightly different timelines. So to suggest that the court didn't err in 2015, but did in 2018 by reaffirming the same order on the exact same facts doesn't really hold water. The second reason that we know that the 2015 order says precisely what respondent says it says, namely for enforcing the decree, you need to sell the home, is because the consensual special magistrate in construing the decree says precisely that the 2015 order enforced the judgment and decree, notwithstanding allegations about the presence of a deed.
Mr. Boulette, would you please address our unpublished decision? I think it's pronounced she versus she, Shay versus Shay, perhaps, which I think appellant seems to say, look, this just means that the quick claim deed automatically supersedes the 1999 property settlement. And I assume, therefore, that he's trying to say then it should meet the criteria under Minnesota Statute 518.145.
I agree with you. That is how appellant's relying on the Shi case. I disagree that that's what Shi says. What the court in Shi did, albeit in an unpublished context, is to look at an instance in which a party entered a decree and subsequently executed a quitclaim deed to satisfy various agreements under that decree. And then the same party who executed the quitclaim deed returns to court and says, I want to be let out of the quitclaim deed and I want to be let out of the decree. And this court applies a basic analysis under 518.145 and says you haven't met your elements. And in addition to that, by signing this quitclaim deed, you have in essence reaffirmed the very same agreements you made in this decree. And because you did that, we're not going to give you relief from the decree's prospective application. So in Shi, you have a very different set of circumstances where the quitclaim deed is in essence belt and suspenders as to why the 518.145 analysis that appellant's urging doesn't hold water. Here, there is an attempt by appellant at the district court level or before this court to do that 518.145 analysis. He doesn't walk you through the basis that he thinks he should be relieved from the operation of the decree. We've tried to get to that basic principle by process of elimination, right? We know it can't be mistake. We know it can't be ordinary fraud. And so from our perspective, the sole basis he's been alleging is, in essence, by executing this decree, you've released the obligation. It constitutes a release under the final prong. We don't see that as being the case for a number of reasons. First and foremost, that this is ultimately a fact decision for the district court to reach. And the district court had these facts in front of it, admittedly a fairly sparse factual record, and it didn't find that Mr. Branchin had met that burden. We don't see that as abuse of discretion, right? And when you look back at the record that actually walks the court through what the information it had in front of it, it's a really bare and very carefully chosen set of allegations, right? One, that she drafted and signed a deed. That she kept the deed, that she signed the deed sometime in 11, where the record also reflects Ms. Weitzel had recently been released from the hospital for mental health issues. And three, that it was kept in the home she shared with Mr. Branchin.
But do we even have to reach these issues? Isn't it simply that there was a motion made in that Shea case for relief under 518.145, and there wasn't here?
I think that's it, Your Honor. We've perhaps gone further down the analysis route than the court needs to go. You're absolutely right. And for instance, that's been our principal point to the district court all along. If a party wants to be relieved from the operation of a decree, it's fundamentally on them to come to court and say, here's why I want to be relieved of it. And here's my statutory basis. And that's never actually happened here. I think if we're being generous, we would say that was what Mr. Branchin tried to do in response to an enforcement motion in 2015, and he wasn't successful. He didn't articulate the precise legal basis, but there was a motion to enforce in 2015. Mr. Branchin said, you shouldn't enforce, and in essence, here's how I'm trying to prove release, and he didn't prevail. So I agree, I don't know the court needs to go that far down the road. We've tried to understand the issues from the perspective that at least for a number of years, this was a pro se litigant, and trying to construe what we think the court understood him to mean and how he understood himself. I wanted just to be able to offer the opportunity for the court to ask questions, but I don't need to use the remainder of my time unless any of you have questions for me.
I do not. Questions?
I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for participating in this WebEx oral argument. The matter will be taken under advisement and will issue a decision within the statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you.